a lot of studies about children's mostly focus on going to the school or going to the park, but we were interested in understanding the full range of places that children go in their daily basis. It's not always about the traffic danger, but most of the time it's about not enough opportunities to go.
Welcome to Journey with Purpose, episode 26. I'm your host, Randy Plummel. When I'm out about with my kids in the city of New York, I am less afraid of the people on the street and more afraid of people in cars. I see people in cars blow through stop signs. I see people in cars go over the speed limit. I see them not follow traffic lights. I see them parked on the sidewalk. I see them drive on the sidewalk. I see them back up. I hear them honking. There are some places in the city where we prefer not to go. And part of that is because there's too many cars and they're too fast and they do all sorts of wacky things. Today, we talk with two researchers out of Montreal about accessibility for kids throughout the city.
I'm Zahra Tabakoli. I'm a recent PhD graduate from Polytechnique Montreal. I live in Montreal, and my research focuses on sustainable mobility and children's accessibility. In the last few years, I've been working on developing a tool to measure how urban environments could affect children's mobility and children's accessibility, particularly in the relation of the traffic danger.
Excellent. And Owen, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hello. So I'm Owen Waygood. I am a professor of transportation at Polytechnique Montreal in Montreal. And I've been doing research on children's travel for nearly 20 years now. I did my PhD on children's travel in Japan, and I was the lead editor on a book called Transport and Child Well-being.
I was specifically interested in the paper, The Traffic Danger's Potential Impact on Children's Accessibility. I have two kids. I live in Queens, New York. We scooter, we bike, we bus, we subway, we own a car, which we shouldn't own a car in New York. But we are multimodal. And the thing that I always tell my folks and people who live outside of New York, especially in these days, that are like, oh, New York is so dangerous, yada, yada. I say, well, you know what the danger honestly is when we're out and about on the street, not from people, but people in cars. And so I'm super interested in this topic and love for you both to explain the paper to us and why you went about this research. Zahra, can you lead us, please?
This paper examines how traffic danger could impact children's accessibility to different destinations. A lot of studies about children's mostly focus on going to the school or going to the park, but we were interested in understanding the full range of places that children's go in their daily basis. So we identify different categories of destinations, from educational to commercial, leisure, sports, and so on. And then we measure the traffic danger on each street. And then to measure the accessibility, we counted the number of the destinations that children can reach in the first scenario without applying the traffic danger, like in a normal situation. And then we applied that traffic danger and we observed that how much the number of the destinations were decreased. The results show that children's accessibility is reduced up to 75% because of the traffic danger, which is something significant. These reductions not only affect their physical well-being, but also affect their social interactions, their cognitive development, as they lose a lot of opportunities to explore and engage with their environment.
Owen, do you want to fill in? How did Zahra's work and your work work together into a larger view of children's accessibility in the city and safety?
I've been doing research on children's independent travel for 20 years now, and I have three children who are now getting into the teenager years, but I've lived it, I've studied it, and I examine it, and we know parents want to protect their children, and this is justified. So we know from the literature that parents will restrict children's independent travel being trips without a parent. But in that literature, it just says traffic danger. There was nothing about, okay, what is that traffic danger and to what extent does it actually reduce the lived environments of children? So what Zahra was saying about, we can look at, you know, where children can go without traffic danger. And that, if you will, is a potential, right? That's a potential of where children could go. And then we say, okay, but in the reality, when you take into account the traffic danger, their lived environment shrink significantly, which can probably help explain why children nowadays just don't have the same freedoms that they had in the past.
You get enough Gen X parents around, and the conversation almost always leads to, hey, remember when we were kids and we would just run amok in our neighborhood and our only rules, like my only rules was, hey, you can't go past some of these streets. And when the street lights turn on, you better come home. Across my friend group, and this is super anecdotal, but from people who live in New York City all the way to the suburbs in Midwest US, it seems like there's this trend of not feeling like we can give our kids that free range movement. I'm interested in, why do you think that has happened? Is it just anecdotal, or has something changed from the 1980s to now?
So it's a good question, and it's a difficult one, and it's not just one thing that's changed. The built environment hasn't necessarily significantly changed in that period of time, but it is spreading out. And that spreading out is leading to more people driving. And when more people drive, there's more traffic danger. And then parents start becoming concerned. From the sociology research, they also highlight that the idea of a perfect parent has changed. So a perfect parent used to be that you gave children the skills and the ability to get out and explore and be free and be a normal citizen in the city. But the perfect parent now often is viewed as somebody who's always there to protect the child. And so there's social pressures that parents report feeling that they can't let their children go because the expectation of other parents is that they should always be there protecting their child. And then in another area, if you will, the policy objectives has gone from protecting children's right to go places to removing children from danger. And so the policies have been applied aren't necessarily protecting children's right to go places. They're saying, okay, let's get children out of traffic. So if the children just stay at home all the time, the job is done because you protected the child. But the problem is that you've stolen their rights to go places by themselves.
I'd love to hear on what you observed and what you heard from both the kids and from adults.
We observed this in our paper and in our results that confirmed the most important reasons that we observed through our study. It was all coming from the traffic danger, but mostly from the speed. For example, in the peripheral boroughs in Montreal, where they're like mostly residential and not that much opportunities to go for children, the role of the high-speed streets was the most important ones that affect and influence the level of accessibility for children.
Is there any other like surprising results from your work, from your studies?
In our work, we've asked parents, we asked children, and we asked experts, because we often exclude children from these discussions because we think, oh, well, I was a child at some point. I remember, but it seems like we don't. So when you talk to parents, also this aspect that parents think their children need to be in activities all the time. There is some research that basically shows that as cars became more and more prevalent, children basically got removed from the public sphere. And so then the only way for children to be active and to have social interaction was to then take them to these activities. So parents really focus on these very formal activities. But then when we ask children, it's just all these informal spaces that they want to go and meet up with the neighborhood kids, like whether it's an abandoned lot, it's a basketball net in a back alley. Those types of places are what children were valuing, but that's not what the adults, even the experts, are necessarily putting value on. And so then when we make these policies, and even when we think about how a street should be designed, we're doing it from our adult perspective. And sometimes this idea that, oh, all children should be escorted. Well, if your approach is that all children should be escorted, then maybe you shouldn't be surprised that the end result is all children are dependent on parents and that they have to beg their parents who are already time-strapped in order for them to go and meet friends, right? Which is, for me, like a terrible end result that we've arrived at.
Can you share a little bit more about the findings? I'm very interested in how you began to segment out different parts of the city through how people use it and what they desire from both the adult and children's point of view.
one of our main ideas to start this research was that a lot of national surveys ignore children, mostly because the information about children are coming throughout the secondhand information from the adults, which make it not really accurate to measure children's actual behavior. And the different perspectives with these two groups were fascinating because parents mostly refer to formal activities, going to the schools, community centers, parks. But for children, even when they are mentioning the formal activities that there are some available data about that, they were mentioning going to the toy stores or bakeries or chocolate places or grocery stores. These sort of different perspectives was adding a lot of value to our research because it was the first time that we understand the weighting from the perspective of children as the actual users. So this perspective between the weighting of the destinations, between the value of the destinations from the perspective of children and from the perspective of parents was really fascinating for us.
It's almost like, let's look at the city instead of from like adult height.
Yes.
See it from, you know, 1 meter or 38 inches above the ground. So it's like, let's lower it down. Let's look at it with like a childlike thing. I love that. I'm a child of the 80s. And there was definitely places in the back of the park where you just go and you throw rocks and, you know, get dirty. And there was probably dumb stuff we did, but, you know, I'm still here. It's super interesting to see the difference, how both kids and adults are seeing the city. So Zara, you talked about that this was a tool. And if you could wave a magic wand and you, you know, get more funding and get more time and get more things, is this something that you could say, take to other cities? And could WalkScore give you a bag of money? And this could be part of WalkScore 2.0, or maybe the Federal Department of Transportation could do it. Is that the aspiration here?
Well, yes. I believe that what other accessibility measures are doing is that they have the same value for all the destinations and also for all the streets. But the idea of this tool is coming from the fact that not all the destinations are equal for children for travel because, well, children have their own needs. They mostly travel to the local destinations. They have limited walking abilities. So not all those measures are suitable for children. And my magic wand go through and apply these traffic measures, like these traffic penalty scores on each street, and then evaluating children's destinations and finding the place of interventions. The most important part of this tool is for identifying the place of interventions and prioritizing those interventions. For example, finding the pedestrian zones or finding the most dangerous places based on this assessment of the tool. It's not always about the traffic danger, but most of the time it's about not enough opportunities to go, specifically in the residential areas that a lot of opportunities are not within children's walking distance, like a reasonable walking distance. So prioritizing the mixed land use or more walkable neighborhoods is something that I would add to this, yes.
Owen, if you could wave a magic wand and a bag of money comes from somebody, like what could this tool be for you?
It's a great question. I actually used WalkScore as the example when I was proposing the project, because I think a lot of people are familiar with WalkScore as a way to measure, are there daily needs that are within a walking distance? And then knowing, again, from the children's research that, okay, it could be walking distance, but that doesn't mean that a child's going to be allowed to go there or that the child themselves feel comfortable to cross those. So waving a magic wand, as Zara is saying, that we would want to be able to measure these, well, this measure of traffic danger, that we would be able to apply it in different cities. We do hope to continue the research in that direction. And then the things that Zara has done, like if you just look at it purely, the kind of that WalkScore side is saying, okay, WalkScore, it's a great tool for adults and their needs. There's bars, there's all these other aspects in there. But okay, what about for children and having an understanding that some of those destinations are more valuable to children? And so having something, if you will, weighted by that need or that want would be a really crucial tool. And when I was thinking about this project, one of the things I wanted was it's not just for the policymakers. Like, we work with the City of Montreal. This is City of Montreal helped finance this work. But I would ideally like is that parents could look and be like, oh, okay, I'm thinking about moving to this neighborhood. Like, how does it rank in terms of this, if you will, like the child watch score? Because a lot of places, unfortunately, that people think they're like, oh, like I have a kid, so I need to move out to this area that they kind of perceive as being child friendly because there's more house space. But then in reality, you're basically imprisoning your child. Those destinations definitely, like in the suburbs, unfortunately, are going to really limit the opportunities that your child has to, unfortunately, live a full life, if you will, that they will be locked into a dependence upon you, which increases stress for parents because all parents want to provide for their children, but then they've kind of locked themselves into this situation where they have to be the one taking their kids everywhere to do these things. There's a very famous Japanese TV show, Hajime no Otsukai, which is in English, Your First Errand. And then on Netflix, I think it was called Old Enough. That whole aspect that kids can go by themselves, they can. But one of the critical things is that traffic danger. And people will say, oh, what about the social danger? But they're linked, right? Like, when you have a super busy street, nobody wants to be on that street and nobody's going to have a conversation. There's great research by Donald Appleyard in New York showing how people's kind of social connections and what they believed is their living space reduces as your level of traffic goes up. And when we reduce that traffic danger, it's not just children that benefit. There's all these other parts of the population that benefit. And when people are out there, the majority of people are good people. And when you have lots of good people out there, you become socially safer. So there's so many of these ties in there.
I get excited for approaches like this because I work a lot with federal, state, and local governments. And as you know, they are starved of capacity and capability. And so anytime that we could use and bring tools that can help them make good choices, and I get inspired by the part around here where something like this could help both policymakers and, like you said, the parents or maybe school officials advocate for different interventions because this starts to become evidence. I wonder if part of the next steps of this tool could be linking analyzed street. And now here's a range of potential interventions from speed humps and speed controls to daylighting intersections to filtering and things like that. Here's where the current ground truth is. Let's try a couple of interventions and see what might happen. And if you do this, this sort of thing might happen.
Yeah, Randy, that's honestly where we're at right now in the work that we're doing with two cities, so Montreal and Westmount. The next steps are basically building prioritization tools on where we need to intervene to reduce traffic danger. And then depending on the source of the traffic danger, then saying, okay, what is the type of intervention that needs to be implemented?
Yeah, as Owen explained, I believe that this tool is a perfect tool for finding the place of interventions, but also prioritizing the different interventions. And I believe that the whole intervention could include the redesigning streets or coming through, improving the infrastructure, or creating policies to encourage walking and biking. We believe that this can highlight the importance of designing cities for children, because if it's safe for children, as like the most vulnerable group, it would be safe for everybody. Creating safe and accessible city for children would benefit everyone. When we design streets that are safe for the most vulnerable group of the society, like children, it creates like a more inclusive environment for all the people. So I hope these kind of works encourage a shift toward city planning that considers the needs of children and also by extension the well-being of the community for all.
If you talk to any parent, they'll know about traffic danger, but it was abstract. And what we're trying to do with these tools is actually make it a concrete concept and be able to present it in a visual manner through these maps so that the policymakers and the parents can actually see how that's impacting the children's lives in a more transparent way. that it's not just some abstract idea that remains up in the sky. And hopefully by doing that, the children will be directly taken into account when we do our transportation planning, and that we will stop ignoring this part of the population and assuming that planning for parents to drive around isn't necessarily the better thing for children's lives. My name is Owen Waygood. I'm a professor of transportation engineering at Polytechnique Montreal in Canada. I am a father of three children who are now 11, 14, and 15. And I've been working on children's independent travel and how it impacts their lives for about 20 years now.
I'm Zara Tabakoli. I'm a transport engineer in Polytechnique Montreal. And my research focuses on sustainable mobility, children's accessibility, and children's independent mobility.
All right, that was Journey with Purpose, episode 26. My special thanks to Zara and Owen for hopping on the phone with me. As Adam Greenfield says, the city is for us to use, and it's for all of us. It's for us in wheelchairs. It's for us in strollers. It's for us in bikes. It's for us on the sidewalk. It's for us walking around. It's us in scooters. Yes, cars have a place in our mobility spectrum, but as we continue to redefine and roll back the primacy of cars in our life, especially in urban built-up areas, we need to make sure that we design for all the people, including kids. So thank you all for listening today. If you want to support the podcast, you can like this episode, you can share it with your friends, you can rank us, heart us, give us a 5.0 rating, hopefully on Spotify or Apple. All those non-monetary benefits help. You can also buy some pamphlets on jwp.news. As usual, the points of view, the beliefs, and the comments don't necessarily reflect the beliefs, comments, or ideas of our employers, but you knew that. We wish everyone a special day and see you on the internets.